session number 27344, reel 29.
Wimber Candlelight, reel 29.
Another report that I did was on the salaries paid to men who were promoted from non-commissioned rank to commissioned rank, and I thought that it was done very badly. For example, if a man was a chief petty officer, he would have increments of pay at certain stages in his career. But if he volunteered to become commissioned and actually succeeded, his pay as a commissioned officer started off at about the same level he had been when he was a chief petty officer, and he did not get the increments that the chief petty officer got. So it meant that if he was volunteering to become a warrant officer, as it was then, or to become a Lieutenant SD, as it was called, SD meaning special duties, he was penalised financially in two ways. One, he didn't get the salary increments, and two, he was required to pay a mess bill, which he hadn't been required to pay as a, at least not the amount he was required to pay as a chief petty officer. And I was doing my level best to persuade people that this was iniquitous, grossly unfair on very intelligent men, and we were losing out in the commissioned ranks people who could have served the Navy extremely well in the special duties that they were expert in. And I had produced, in fact it was too big, a fairly hefty report on payment and salaries by through all the Fleet Air ranks. And this, unfortunately, was more than people were prepared to read, to tell you the truth. And it never got anywhere. And this is when my captain in charge in the personnel panel said, "Well, to tell you the honest truth, I understand what you're trying to do, but I find it too heavy going." And I wasn't prepared to finish reading it myself, so why would anyone else? So unfortunately, that didn't go very far. But when I was making these points down at Leon Solent, I met with terrific sympathy and support there on this subject, because it applied to so many of the people that I was friendly with. But you know, the ratings who were promoted to SD branch often found it quite difficult when they got into the wardroom, because, to be honest, some of the naval wives were just a bit catty, and they looked down their noses at the wives of those who had been promoted from the lower deck. I thought that was so sad, because again, as I say, the men were intelligent and their wives were lovely people. And why the others should be so bloody stupid about it, I really don't know. But it did make them very sad that there should be anybody, not the majority, but that there should be anybody who would treat them like that. But it's just one of the things that the Navy did badly. I expect they still do, because nobody's read my report.
Did your captain give you any advice on what the optimum length of a report should really be?
Oh, yes. One side of a foolscap page. Foolscap in those days. A4 now. But it was just such a difficult situation to explain that I just couldn't have done it. I couldn't have condensed it to that size without just sort of making bold statements. And The thing is, if you make these bold, unsupported statements, people look at it and say, well, I wonder if that's true. And then if they're going to have to read through 40 or 50 pages to find if it is true or not, they're just not prepared to do it. No, I can understand why, but it was sad. Perhaps I'm just not good enough at making a précis to produce the report on one side of a foolscap page. But I can understand how senior officers who have got so many different subjects to deal with in a day, why they can't afford the time to read through these things. And why a good secretary has to learn how to make a précis. I wonder if they do nowadays. I bet they don't.
But at this stage, obviously you were in a kind of staff role within there. You had that kind of ended your flying career at that stage. Was
oh, yes.
Within the Fleet Air Arm that you would have to have given up flying, or did you ever? How did you see your career progressing?
Well, when I was 39 or 40, something just in that sort of age, the Admiralty brought out a regulation which said that officers over the age of 40 would not be permitted to fly frontline aircraft. And to be honest, that's all I wanted to do. So if I wanted to carry on flying, I would have had to go into passenger flying. And we had a small squadron which was used to fly people around the various naval air stations, including going out to Malta. But that was... the pilots in that squadron were all old and bold, as we say. In the Fleet Air Arm, there are either old pilots or bold pilots, but no old, bold pilots. But anyway, these ones were old and bold in the passenger aircraft. And we used to fly the de Havilland Dove, and that was the two-engine de Havilland passenger aircraft. And there was a four-engine one, and I can't remember its name. And they just flogged around from the squadron at Leon Solent to Yeovilton and Cordrose down in the West Country, or to Brodie in Wales, or RAF Valley, up to Lossiemouth in the north of Scotland. And those were the sort of stations that they used to go to, because road and rail journeys to them were always tedious with a number of changes. And... I also thought, well, if I take on flying in that squadron in due course, I will perhaps be able to move from that into civil aviation, because I decided I wasn't going to stay in the service. So I thought about this, so I went to have a medical, just to make sure that I would be okay to volunteer for civil aviation. And after the doctor had finished, they said, well, I don't think you'll be able to carry on flying because you've got low blood pressure and you'll be subject to dizziness and perhaps blackouts. And as a matter of fact, I had had a couple of spells, short spells of dizziness. So I thought, oh, well, that's that. But what really annoyed me afterwards was that he didn't say I'd recover from it. Because my blood pressure went back to normal and I was perfectly fit. So I gave up any idea of civil aviation at that point, and because I wasn't going to go into civil aviation, I accepted that I wouldn't be flying the passenger aircraft in the Fleet Air Arm. So I'd given that up. So I was then stuck either in a staff job or something similar. So anyway, the staff job, as it were, in the personnel panel, I really, really disliked. Of course, I suppose one of the reasons I really disliked it was I was living in Leon Solent and working in the Admiralty. So I used to have to get the bus into Gosport, the ferry to Portsmouth, the train to London, the underground to Trafalgar Square, and walk the rest. It used to take me 2.5 hours each way. So it really wasn't an exciting time. While I was in the train, I decided to teach myself German. And it was quite interesting because a very large number of Scottish words are very like the German words. And I was getting on quite well, and learning vocabularies and going on through the grammar, until I got to the point where I was translating the subjunctive. And I wasn't terribly sure what the subjunctive was in English translated into German. So I gave up. Anyway, that was my time in Admiralty. And at the end of that, I was moved to Leon Solent as first lieutenant. First lieutenant is the third in seniority in the executive branch in a station or ship. There's the captain, the commander, who's the executive officer, and then the first lieutenant. And the first lieutenant, generally speaking, is totally responsible for the accommodation and general running of the station. And I quite enjoyed this. I had a small team run by the buffer. And the buffer is the senior of the seamen crew, as it were, who do all the odd jobs around the station. And my buffer was a chief airman. And he was an absolute gem. He really was a most excellent man. Again, as I keep saying about these people, very intelligent, very easy to get on with, and could organise anything anywhere. He'd just say, "Buffer, I need so-and-so done." And he'd say, "Right, sir." And he'd go off and do it and come back and report that it was done. And it was such an easy job to do when you had someone like that at your beck and call. The other responsibility I had, of course, was the cleanliness of the station and the appearance of the station, which included the gardens. And the gardens at Leon Solent were really rather nice, and they were looked after by a team of civilians, sort of dockyard mateys who weren't in a dockyard. And I got on extremely well with them. And my walking around the air station, I'd often stop and have chats with the gardeners, asking them what they were doing, what they were intending to do, and why. And it really was great. One of the other sort of men that I had that I could use was a sailmaker. Now, you imagine a sailmaker on a naval air station. He had absolutely sweet Fanny Adams to do. So he and I used to look around for work for him. And he was good. He really was very, very experienced naval rating. But his job was just not required. So we did use him to do what we call tiddlywork. Anything that required to be produced to look good in a naval fashion, we'd discuss it with him and decide how it was going to be done, and then he would do it. You know, for example, if you were putting ropes around a bed of flowers and you wanted it done in a particular way, discuss it with him, discuss it with the civilians, and let them get on with it together. And that, you know, I quite enjoyed doing it, but I was really waiting to leave the service. It was an interesting job. Of course, one of the jobs that I had to do was to supervise the civilian window cleaners who came in, and they would clean the outsides of the windows on all the barrack blocks, whereas the airmen and seamen, etc., would clean the inside of the windows when they were doing up the mess decks. And the man in charge of the window cleaners used to come and see me and say, "The windows have all been done. Would you like to come and inspect them?" So he and I would walk around a number of the, just picking at random, the blocks that would be inspected. And he showed me how to check windows above ground level to make sure they'd been cleaned. And it worked very well, because if I went into the building, went up and put my hand out to check on the outside, having looked at it from down below and said, "That one's not cleaned, and go and look at it," it wasn't. And if you could say, "Yes, it was cleaned," and then go and check it, it was just a matter of getting reflections right. And it was very useful having that sort of information passed on. But we had weekly mess deck inspections. And my job was to make sure that the mess decks were ready for the commander to do his rounds, which he used to do weekly, and the captain used to do rounds once a month. And when the captain did rounds, he used to take with him some of the heads of departments, such as the senior supply officer or someone like that, would go around with them. And we had competitions amongst the mess decks to see who would be the best mess deck. And, of course, once you got a best mess deck, that was due to the leading hand of the mess deck, who made sure that his mess deck was right, because he was a leader. And he would make sure that the men in that block kept his mess absolutely spotless. And they were. They were amazingly good. And I used to go around and I was trying my damnedest to find somewhere which wasn't properly cleaned. It was a competition between me and them to see what wasn't done properly. And one thing which I found right at the beginning was that the urinals hadn't been properly cleaned for years. And it was very hard water area, and the lime scale had hardened on the urinals, and it was just impossible to get them looking clean. Even if you'd used bleach, you might change the colour, but you weren't getting rid of the dirty lime scale. So I did an investigation as to how we were going to get rid of lime scale, and I've forgotten the name of the stuff that I found we used at home, which was quite successful, but slow. I mean, it would take a number of applications of this stuff. I've forgotten the name of it. But anyway, I got permission to buy some of this to try it. So I'd go to the mess decks, which has usually been best for the mess decks, and talk it over with the leading hand and explain to them how to use this stuff and to be careful with it, because it was such a very strong acid, and also because it was bloody expensive. So we gave them brushes and rubber gloves and told them how to use it. And over the period, they gradually started to clean the urinals, but it did take many months. But because they could see it was being successful, they did try hard, and many of the mess decks cleaned up these urinals, which had been mucky for a long, long time. That's the sort of thing that we used to do. And we got to the stage where we couldn't stop this one particular mess deck being best mess deck. Whoever inspected it, they knew it was best mess deck. And I got to the point where I wasn't giving the points, the commander wasn't giving the points, and the captain wasn't giving the points. It was the travelling head of department, who didn't normally go around mess decks, who would give the points to the mess decks, and we hoped that now and again some different mess deck would get the points, but it's amazing how often it came back to the same one. And of course that's discouraging for those who don't make it. But again, you see, it all depends on the leading hand of the mess deck. If he is a leader, he will get it clean and tidy and looking good. I mean, it's just, for example, the way they fold up the blankets and leave them on the beds, that sort of thing. And, of course, with the junior rates, they always folded up all the blankets and sheets and pillows and put them at the top of the bed, and you were left looking at the mattresses. And very early on, when I was going round, I was astonished to see how many of the mattresses were stained with urine. So I started to discuss this not only with my commander, but with the other ratings, you know. And they said, well, the drawback is that you're quite close to the NAFI, and if they tank up in the NAFI and then stagger back to bed, the worse for drink. They haven't had time to get rid of their urine before they get into bed, and because they're drunk, they wet the bed. So I was absolutely, well, to put it mildly, disgusted. So I started a program of cleaning, steam cleaning mattresses which had been stained. And this became quite a big program, and we were sending, I don't know, perhaps 10 mattresses a week to be steam cleaned. So it occurred to me, if this was happening amongst the junior ratings, is it happening amongst the senior ratings? So inspecting the petty officers and chief petty officers' messes, I said to the president of the mess, I would like to have a look at some of the mattresses. So they agreed, and the petty officers and chief petty officers' beds were left made up. They weren't folded. So they stripped back a couple of the beds so that I could see the mattresses. And lo and behold, we had nearly the same proportion of wet urine marks amongst the petty officers. So I said, well, either you, as president of the mess, are going to clear this up, or I am. I don't want to impose it on you, but you will have to inspect all the mattresses and send those that need to be cleaned to be cleaned. And you'll let me know how many you're sending each week, and see if we can stop this lark. We couldn't stop it, but at least we stopped the beds being unhygienic. So I went to the chief petty officer's mess, and the president there was absolutely adamant. There was no way I was going to inspect their mattresses. So I explained the problem to him. I said it has occurred with junior rates and it has occurred with the petty officers. I suspect there might be some amongst the chief petty officers, but not nearly so many. They're more mature men. They don't get drunk in the same way. But I want you to inspect them all and tell me if there were any that had to be cleaned. And there were where? There were a few, you know, two or three, as opposed to where it was 10 to 20 in the other lots. But it was just one of the sort of things that the first lieutenant does in the station to keep it clean, healthy, tidy, good looking. And that was my job. And I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Could I ask about that? Because obviously you mentioned drinking was the cause of really that happening. How much did drinking play a role within station life? Was it a big thing that the ratings and the petty officers would do?
No. It was just a normal thing that we know naval ratings drink. They don't all get drunk. Some of them drink more than they should, and some drink more than they can cope with. But it wasn't a major problem, ever.
Was it cheap in the Naffy, though, to get
cheaper? It might be, I don't know, perhaps 10 pence a pint cheaper in the Naffy than it was outside. But they weren't always allowed to go ashore because there were watches, and there was a duty watch. We were divided into four watches. There was always a duty watch on board, so three watches could go ashore and one had to remain on board. And the one that remained on board, they were allowed to go and spend their time in the Naffy unless they were called out to do a job. Such as on one occasion when we had a real gale, our MFV, which was normally anchored out in the Solent, was blown ashore. And it came ashore just at the my memory is getting terrible for words. Where you would launch boats, what do you call that?
Slipway.
Slipway, thank you. We had a big slipway at Leon Solent that the hovercraft used to use. And the MFV was blown ashore there, and I had to get the duty watch out to deal with that. But that's the sort of thing why you had a duty watch, was in case something went wrong. On another occasion, the night before I got married, this is going back a bit, the night before I got married, there was another stormy night, and a barracuda flying back into Leon Solent, ditched in the Solent, So we had to organise the rescue of the crew from the Solent. So that again was a matter of getting everyone in the jury watch who was concerned battling about. And that was my stag night. But as first lieutenant, all these things kept cropping up. And it just meant that if you're sitting at your desk, every telephone call was on a different subject. And it meant you were kept mentally active and physically active, because I was walking around the station a lot of the time, and I did enjoy it, because it was a very pleasant air station to be at.
You mentioned how clean the mess decks were.
Yeah.
Now, as a civilian, are there elements of cleaning a room that, that the Navy would do that might seem strange to us? You said that every surface was clean. Would they clean under things, around things, that sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely. Every bed was moved out. And down that side of the mess deck was polished. Then the beds were moved back and the other side moved over. Down the other side was polished. Then all the beds put back in their correct position, and down the centre was polished. And it was polished in the last seconds before an inspection. So when you went in, it was gleaming, smelling nice, and absolutely immaculate. All the windowsills would be wiped clean and absolutely clean. The inside of the windows, as I went round, I always tried rubbing my hand on the inside of the glass, along the sills, and in any awkward corner, no matter how awkward it was, I'd go and have a look, because I had to get the mess decks right. But they were good. They really got into the habit of living in a clean and hygienic environment. And that was the whole purpose of it. Because in a ship, they live so closely together, you can't afford to let them be untidy or dirty in any way.
Would that be a source of friction as well amongst your messmates aboard ship?
Oh, if somebody was, shall we say, not bathing or showering as often as he might, and if there was some body odour, in no time at all he'd be put in a shower and scrubbed down with rough brushes. And that is what you call rough justice, because they just couldn't stand it. And they had to be used to living together in very close proximity. See, in a ship, you would find that the bunks, once we got rid of hammocks, in bunks there were three bunks within a 6'6" ceiling. So they were only, 18 inches apart. And they were up this side and up that side, and you'd have perhaps 15 or 18 ratings living together in very close proximity, eating together, amusing themselves, doing reading or writing or jigsaws or carving or whatever they did to keep themselves amused. It was done in this very close proximity. And for example, they were never ever allowed to dry clothing that they had washed in the mess deck. There was a drying room. So it meant that in the Navy, every item of clothing, every item was marked with your name. And it would, when you did your dobying, as they called it, when you washed your clothes, you took it to the drying room and it was hung up in there, all with your name on it. And then you went back and collected it and took it away as soon as it was dry, because other people were waiting for the space. And if something was left there too long, the petty officer of the mess deck would go in and take it, and it would be put in what was called a scran bag. And the scran bag was literally a big bag, like a big kit bag, and the clothing was in there. And every now and again, when the scran bag got fairly full, they would have a sale of the clothing that was in the scran bag. And if you had lost some clothing, you'd have to go and buy it back from the scran bag. And if there was stuff left in the scran bag which wasn't claimed by the original owner and somebody else bought it, the first thing was that the master at arms or his team had to remove the name or blank it out and put the new name on it so that everyone knew legally this was his. So that it did work. And they weren't allowed to dry their clothing in there because the Navy, right from a very early time, was wary of TB. So again, there are reasons for all they were doing and for requiring the highest standards.